Hey, what's good? This is Rich.
And I'm Marcus.
And you're listening to Paychecks and Balances, where we cover work and money with a millennial twist and strive not to leave you saying alternative facts.
I see you switch it up this week, brother.
I did.
And you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at PayBalances and on Facebook and SoundCloud at Paychecks and Balances.
And if you're interested in having your side hustle or business promoted on the podcast without breaking the bank, visit paychecksandbalances.com/small business. We've made it super simple.
Today, we're joined by Kirk Chisholm. Kirk is a principal and wealth manager at Innovative Advisory Group, an independent RIA, registered investment advisor located in Lexington, MA. He has been providing financial advice to individuals and families since 1999. I think that might predate some of the millennials. I'll have to do a little bit of math on there, but it is what it is. You know, that's where the expertise comes from. Kirk's influence and innovation has promoted change in many areas of the wealth management industry. Kirk provides a different perspective on many commonly held beliefs, which we're going to talk about today. Foreshadowing. When it comes to portfolio management, retirement investing, financial planning, inflation, and economics and other personal finance topics, his rare expertise with alternative investments held in self-directed IRAs has helped many investors invest in their passion. Hello, Kirk, and thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Rich. Thanks, Marcus.
No doubt.
And is there anything about your background information you'd like to expand on for the listeners that we didn't hit there?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing I'd like to expand on, because I think if, you know, most people out there, they don't really understand the difference, is I work as a investment advisor representative. We are fee-only advisors. So I've worked on the broker-dealer side. There's a very different aspect to it from what we do versus the brokers in that we are fiduciaries. So effectively, we have a moral and legal responsibility to put our clients' best interests first. So we like to promote the fact that we are investment advisors because it does put us into a different class of advisory services for clients. And also it does allow us to do other things, which of course we'll talk about today.
And so on that note, sometimes the people want to hear how you got into that field. Can you expand a little bit on your background? Is this something that you always wanted to go into? Did you discover a passion along your journey?
Sure. Yeah, I'd happy to. It's funny, when I started being interested in this field, I think I was a freshman in college and it was all the rage. This was back when the internet boom was happening and everybody was making what I would like to call dumb money. They were anything they invested in went up. So it's rising tide raises all boats. So I spent a lot of time investing in college and learning about it and took a few internships at some bigger broker dealers back in the day. And decide that's what I wanted to do. And, you know, it was interesting. When I started at Payne Webber, which is no longer Payne Webber. Now they're UBS. Learned a lot about the business. They had a great training program. I was there for a number of years. And then effectively, my first month in production was December of 99. So if you can imagine a worse time to start in the business, I would love to hear about it because that was the peak of the market. Everybody thought they're making money and the market pretty much went down from there. Mm. So, you know, the one good thing that I got out of that was I did not get spoiled by all the good times because I never had exposure to it. So it really reinforced the principle of risk management, which I think not enough people take to heart. And so, you know, when the market's going down every month for pretty much, you know, 2.5, 3 years, you know, you learn why risk management is important. So that I learned from day one was, you know, rule number one. It's actually Warren Buffett's rule number one too, is don't lose money. And rule number two is make sure you follow rule number one. So, you know, I really like that aspect of my learning curve. Spent a few more years at some other broker dealers and ended up starting this company in 2008, also an opportune time because,
Yeah. So I remember 2008 pretty well. I went into a staffing agency at that time. And as you can imagine, the economy's collapsing. People are losing jobs. Companies aren't hiring as much. Part of my compensation was commission. Very, very painful experience. Very painful.
Yeah, 2008 and pretty much the early 2000s were both painful in many aspects, but 2008 was much worse.
Interesting.
I mean, for us, it wasn't so bad because we were very heavily in cash at that point. But, you know, it's for many reasons. I mean, our industry took a huge hit during that time and has not recovered. And I don't think people really understand that. that a lot of people were laid off and they just never rehired them. And, you know, now when the interest rates go up and the banks start making more money, they're going to be highly profitable because they laid off so many people.
Mm.
But, you know, it, and I think in our industry, it was very hard because I fielded a lot of calls from my colleagues at other firms that were really, you know, losing their mind because the market was down 50% from the peak and all of a sudden their compensation got cut in half. So I'm very thankful that we took a very conservative approach to the markets during that period. And, you know, I think our clients appreciate it too. But I think those times, you would think that they're unique, but they're not. They're becoming more frequent as time passes, unfortunately. And I think that, you know, if you look at 2008, you look at early 2000s, you had a few crises in the late 90s. So these things just keep happening. And, you know, people have to understand the markets, just like real estate. The markets don't go up forever. They have ups and downs. And you have to understand that and be able to cope with the fact that it doesn't always go up.
Right, right. Now, I hear some people, because I'm based out in the Bay Area, so I'm right in Silicon Valley, and I hear some folks talking about how we're on the verge of another tech bubble. Do you feel that way, just based off of what you've seen?
I'd say yes and no. So in one sense, you could look at the real estate prices in Silicon Valley and see that there's a bubble. I mean, it's crazy. I had a friend of mine who was considering taking a job at a big financial firm out there and probably would have done well. And he said, honestly, the compensation they were giving me, I couldn't find a shack to live in. It was just,
I believe it.
The prices are too crazy. And in other ways, I think there's way too much Wall Street money funneling out there. So if that ever slows down, that would, in effect, cause that bubble to, I don't want to say pop, because technology is a little different. It's not like it was in early 2000s where people invest in a concept before it makes money and they just figure it's going to go up and who cares if it makes money.
Mm.
Now, there's still a very strong trend to technology, but people are a little bit more cautious about what they put their money. They know that they're making a gamble if they're not making a profit at this point. But I think the concept of investing in technology, just like biotech, is the same. You're investing in a dream. You know that you're more or less potentially going to lose your money, but you're hoping that if you invest in a few of these that, you know, at least one will make it big. And that's what a lot of, you know, venture capitalists, angel investors do. They invest in 10 or 15 in companies and they hope two of them do really well. They assume the vast majority will break even and, you know, maybe three or four will lose money. But the numbers show that if those winners do well, they do, you know, 10, 20, 30x and they make a good return overall. So I think that concept is still strong. And other than the fact that people can't afford to live there, I don't know what's going to really pop that bubble other than the Wall Street money drying up.
Got it. Got it. And what about for people who are early on in the investing game? We have a lot of people who are just starting to look into this. It's something that I've just started to think about more recently. Any advice for someone who's just kind of starting from scratch and trying to figure out where to go in terms of understanding all of this investment stuff?
Sure. I'll say this much. If somebody has money, let's say you get a huge bonus and you have like 50, 100,000 or even 20,000, doesn't matter, but it's a large sum for what you've been saving. Before you decide to go, and I'll put this in air quotes, gamble with your money, investing is not gambling. And I think people have to understand the concept is it's too easy to invest in anything, you know, stocks, mutual funds. It's really easy to invest. And because it's so easy, people take a kind of a haphazard approach to investing. What I tell most people is if you're going to get new investing and you're going to do it yourself, because, you know, people's personality are different. Some people want advice and some people are do-it-yourselfers. And I totally respect that. I'm a do-it-yourselfer, so I get it. One thing I would suggest is that what people do is they take 6 months to a year and invest in nothing. Just keep it in cash. Discipline yourself to not do anything with that money, no matter how many good ideas you find.
Hmm.
But create that discipline that allows you to be in control of your emotions. Because investing is, to pull a Yogi Berra quote, investing is 90% mental and, you know, 20% physical. It's not really about, you know, seeing if a stock is a good buy. It's about battling your emotions. It's battling your psychology and understanding your psychology and knowing what you are good at and what you're not good at. And it takes professional investors decades to master this. So it's important that people at least understand the battle that's going on in your head in that your fear and greed are going to help you make decisions you may not want to make. Mm-hmm. And as long as you understand that, it will help you make better decisions. So people, if investors take the next 6 to 12 months and learn everything they can about investing, that is going to be the best investment you can make initially, because then you'll know at least a good amount of information of what you should and shouldn't do. And then you can start small and make small investments. And, you know, don't make investments into the next Facebook or the next Amazon, because the likelihood is you're not going to find it. You should focus on making solid investments. And if you want to take a percentage of your money, let's say like 5%, 10%, but pick an amount that you can part with knowing that you're going to throw it away, and take 5 or 10% and invest it in those things that, you know, that make you happy and you think you're going to make 100 times your money. Mm. And know that you're potentially going to lose it. But as long as you're only doing it with a small part, then, you know, you're only losing a small part of it. But I think that as a concept is a good way to start your investing career. And if you don't know what you're doing, you don't want to hire an advisor, then choose an index fund or something simple like that. Because investing is not for everybody. I do this full time and I still don't have enough hours in the day. So I don't know how people with a full-time job do this well unless they're choosing index funds or they're choosing a strategy that requires very little amount of time.
Got it.
So we're going to talk a little bit about that more. So I want to give a shout out to Ivan, who has a listener question. But our primary topic today, and we've touched on a little bit here, is going to be home ownership, renting, and owning. You wrote a great three-part series at innovativewealth.com, which I'll plug in the show notes for our listeners here. And the first and most obvious one is, should you rent or buy a home? A quote from that article is the American dream really an illusion? There's a great illusion when it comes to real estate, and that illusion is that owning your home is an investment. So my first question there, and probably for the individuals at home as well, probably people sitting in their home devastated right now, is why is the mindset that home ownership is an investment possibly inaccurate?
Well, it's an interesting concept that actually Fannie Mae came up with. You know, if you went back decades, this American dream of owning a home wasn't the American dream. That was never the concept that was in people's head. Fannie Mae actually created it to encourage more people to own homes. And the homeownership industry has kind of built off from there. So there's nothing wrong with owning a home or not owning a home, but they just understand that that concept has been pushed by them and our government officials in decades since. So I think the important thing that people should realize is owning a home is not an investment. It's a personal expense. And as long as you understand the difference, then you'll be in a better place to make better choices. Take an example. Let's say you own a single family home. It costs you $2,000 a month to live there versus renting a home that also costs you $2,000 a month. Some people would say that, well, you're renting. You're throwing money away. Maybe you're throwing money away, but you're also paying $2,000 to own a home. So are you throwing that money away? It still costs you money to live there. And are you making any income from owning your home? Probably not. It's still an expense. So, you know, sure, you could say it's some of it's going to principal and the home prices appreciate, but they don't always appreciate. I mean, look at Japan. They've been going down for decades. Mm-hmm. What if you owned a home in Japan? You'd be losing money every year. And depending on the price of your home, it may actually be more expensive to own a home than to rent it. So I think people need to understand the difference of personal expense versus investment. Now, if you had a multifamily home and you're living in one part of it, that's an investment. But if you're not making income off of it and you're assuming the appreciation part is your investment, that's speculation. That's not investment.
Hmm. Why do you phrase that as speculation?
Well, we like to look at real estate in this way. If you're buying investment property to rent out, you can predict your income because you know what the rent's going to be. Sure, people can decide to not pay you, but let's assume for a minute that, you know, people are going to pay their rent every month. You know what your expectations are for your income every month, and you know what your net profit will be. But can you tell me what your home is going to be valued at next year or the year after, or the year after that?
Nope.
Okay.
No one can. You have no idea. I mean, people assume it goes up until 2008, people did. But, you know, I'm not here to suggest that home prices are going to go down. But the reality is you can't predict the home price appreciation or depreciation in any given year. You just don't know. So that's not an investment. That's speculation. That's like investing in, let's use a company like Tesla, for instance. You're investing in Tesla. It's not really profitable. People are investing, speculating on the fact that it'll be worth much more in the future and that hopefully someday they'll make a profit. But this is nothing against Tesla, because there are many companies out there that are like this, and they're highly valued. People have put a high price tag on them because they assume that next year, the year after, 10 years from now, they'll be worth, you know, much more in value. The same thing with homes. You can speculate on what the price will be in future years, but you have no idea. They could come by and the government could institute some sort of they could take your land from you and, you know, give you some value they determined. You don't know. So the point is you can predict it, but you don't know. So I look at it as a speculation. It's a bonus. It's money that you hope you're going to get, but I like to predict income, not growth.
Makes sense to me.
Okay. And you have two other additional quotes here, and I think that's going to tie into a concept that we've talked about as far as lifestyle inflation, but this happens to go to home ownership. And those are, so some go as far to become house poor so that they can leverage themselves into a bigger home. And there's also a social stigma, which we've also talked about on the show, to being a renter versus an owner. Have you seen this either social stigma or this need to not be quote unquote house poor impact individuals' purchasing decisions?
Absolutely. So I live in the Northeast, and I can tell you from my perspective, and certainly different parts of the country have different social stigmas, but in this part of the country, it's socially acceptable to own a home, right? You're seen as being successful or as, you know, successful enough. There's nothing wrong with renting, but that's kind of generally speaking, if you want to keep up with the Joneses, then you want to own a home. So if people think you're renting, they'll think, oh, well, he doesn't have any money. I know of a lot of very wealthy people that rent that don't own, but that's the stigma. So, you know, if those kind of things are important to you, then that is something that you have to consider. But if you're just looking at the numbers, it's not really the best way to look at owning a home. Being house poor is a concept that I think probably a lot of people understand, is that people will leverage themselves up into owning a home. If you're around for 2006 to 2010, you're probably familiar with this concept. People will, they buy a home for, let's say, $100,000, they'll put $5,000 up and leverage up just to own the home, assuming that it's going to go up in price. And that's fine unless the house drops $5,000 in value, in which case you have no equity in the home. So I think a lot of people, what they'll do is they'll put as much money as they can down and they'll have no savings. They won't put money into a 401k. They won't go out to eat. They just don't have enough money to live their life because they put so much money into their house, because houses are so expensive. And if you've never bought a house before, you wouldn't believe the things you have to pay for. I'll give you a perfect example. Let's say you never owned a home before. You're renting an apartment in the city. You just got married. You want to move to the burbs. You're going to buy this house, which is, say, four times the size square feet interior or whatever. You got some more space. The first thing you're not going to think about is how much is going to cost you to furnish that house.
Ooh.
Ooh. So I have some friends that upsized from an apartment to a house, and they had, let's say, at least five rooms that were completely empty for 2+ years because they just couldn't afford to buy all the furniture for their entire house. It's just a hidden concept that people don't think about. So buying a house is nice, and you think, oh, insurance, taxes, mortgage, that's all I got to worry about. But there's so much more to worry about, and the costs are potentially much higher. And I think that's the problem. If you're on edge of barely making it, being quote-unquote house poor, any one of those costs that you didn't figure in or didn't expect could put you over. And that's the problem. In the Northeast, real estate is so expensive that I honestly don't know how people actually afford to live here. So, you know,
you
look at the median home price.
That's a great point, because we joke from time to time. And actually, I think, I don't know if it's a joke or a laugh to keep from crying, but we watch these HGTV programs.
I was thinking it.
And it's always, you know, stay-at-home mom and jazz musician dad, like, have $800,000 budget. And they never stick to the budget. They're like, they go out with $800,000, look at, like, a $1.5 million home, and we'll take it. And then they cut to commercial break. And I'm like, what is going on here? It never makes any sense to me. And it does seem to either be in Northeast or West Coast. I was watching one that I finally could relate to, and it made no sense. They were like in Atlanta. Dude had a budget of like $47,000. I'm like, yes.
That sounds more like it.
Yeah, that's something I can relate. He was looking at like two condos and an apartment. And I did want to clarify that. So when you're saying renting, just for the listeners and maybe even myself, you're just mean a dwelling. So you may be renting a home as well, right? That we're referring to. You're just saying the difference between renting and a mortgage, regardless of whether it's a home dwelling.
Yes. So I'm referring to renting a home that you're living in.
Okay. Okay. And do you have any tips for, you know, when you're seeing these friends or, you know, the listeners or just maybe anyone for avoiding, I'm just going to call this keeping up with the Joneses, that you've seen be practical or sustainable?
So, I mean, I have a different psychology around this in that I just don't care what people think. So if they think I'm poor, let them think that. I just don't care, right? And I'm not going to tell them because I, you know, for most people, if they know me well enough, they'll know. And if they don't, it's none of their business. And I think if you have that mindset, then, you know, you're probably not going to worry about it. But a lot of people do worry about it. And I don't want to overstep this because I think the difference between renting and owning, a good number of the points, the differences, are actually emotional and they have absolutely nothing to do with finances. So, you know, I don't want to overlook that because let's say whether you're a man or a woman, if you're a man, your wife's probably more emotionally attached to a feeling because, you know, women are. They're touched with their feelings more than we are. And let's just say hypothetically they have a feeling about the house and that it feels good to them. You can't overlook that. And you can't say that, you know, it's unimportant because it is important. And you can look at it from the financials and say, all right, this is either a good fit or it's not a good fit. This is going to be, you know, less expensive than this. But it's a home. It is a personal expense for a reason. It's money you're spending to enjoy your life. So you can't overlook that and assume that it's all about the numbers, because if you're living in a house that you don't enjoy, then why are you spending money on it at all? So I think that aspect has to be an important part of the equation. You can't quantify that with numbers, but it is, you know, one of the differences. So some people having that sense of ownership and the sense of making the changes they want to make to the house is an important part of the equation. And if your landlord does not let you make those changes, then you won't be as happy than if they do. So there are other sides to this where it's not just about numbers. I'm a numbers guy, so that's what I talk about. But I think it's important to consider the other parts, like we're talking about, like talking to your peers and explaining whether, you know, you're owning or buying. And, you know, if you own, great. You know, people think, hey, you've done something well. And quite frankly, I think if you can buy something at a deep discount to what it's worth, it doesn't matter whether you rent or buy. If you buy it well enough, it will always have a good value. If you buy it 20% below market price, you're going to create equity for yourself. So there's some advantage there. But I think that if people look at the concept of renting versus buying, and I'll give you an example, and I actually discussed this in one of the blog posts. I had a client who was looking to move, right? And they were looking at properties, and they found one property. And this, you know, it's the Northeast, so this is not such a high price, but in other parts of the country it may be. But they were looking at a property for like $1.4 million. And I wrote about this property, and they could have also rented this property for $4,000 a month.
Mm.
Now, if you look at the numbers, $4,000 a month is a third of the cost of what it would take each month to own that property.
Wow.
So how important is it to own it? If I went in and rented that property for $4,000 a month, nobody is going to assume, you know, they're going to assume that I own that property. They're not going to assume that I'm renting it. Unless you tell them, they're not going to know. So you have to think about it this way. If you move to a nice house, people aren't going to say, oh, did you buy it or rent it? They're not going to ask. They're only going to ask if you bring it up. So I think in many parts, it's up to you as to how you present it. But it's not a question that people in polite society ask, oh, how much do you pay for your house?
Yeah.
Unless it's your neighbor.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, and so I was going to ask along those lines, should people be going as far when they're looking at renting? So somebody may not be interested in buying a house for years, but should people be going as far as looking at the cost of the house on a Trulia or one of those sites as part of the evaluation process for renting? Or is that just a little too extra?
I think that, you know, if you're going to make, so there are a few financial decisions, which are enormous financial decisions that you make in your life. One of them happens to be home purchase. That's one of the bigger ones. Another one is sending your kids to college, getting married, having kids. These are all big, important financial decisions you make in your life. So if you're going to be spending 20% of what the property is worth and sticking it in the property that you basically never see until you sell it, you want to make sure it's the right decision.
Mm.
So I think that from an investor standpoint, you just have to consider the aspects that are important to you.
Got it.
Yeah.
Another thing that I've seen, and this is where we get to the painful portion of the show, folks, but we're going to end on a happy note. I haven't figured out what that note is, but we're going to get back to it. The concept that I've kind of seen fading away and seems to be in frustration to the real estate articles that I'm reading on it is the starter home doesn't seem to be happening for millennials anymore. It seems that millennials are just buying a home, and I guess, you know, time will tell, as you alluded to earlier, whether they'll stay there forever. But do you have thoughts on a starter home versus, I mean, I think it was like a three-part process before you bought your starter home. You know, built some equity, and then you upgraded to your secondary home when you had a family, and then you retired to what would ultimately be your final home. I don't think too many paid off a true 30-year mortgage. Do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, and I was going to say real quick, so this sounds like the level up idea you were talking about. Would that be right, Kirk, with the idea of the starter home?
Yeah, so starter homes are great. And I think that, you know, to my earlier comment of how do people afford to live here? Well, I think the only way people can afford to live here is they do start with a starter home. They do build up equity, you know, because it is in a way a savings account, right? So you're buying a home for, let's say, $100,000 as a starter home, which in this part of the country wouldn't even be a starter home. That'd be, you know, be lucky if you could buy land for that price.
That'd be a tiny home.
You know, you start with a property, you're paying principal and interest every month, and the principal goes into the equity. So even if the home price doesn't change, you're effectively increasing your equity every month by your payments. And that, you know, as your income increases, because if you look at your income over your lifetime, it starts out low and increases, and it peaks right around the time that your kids go to college. And, you know, fortunately, I guess, but, you know, that's usually when it peaks. And then as you get really close to retirement, it starts to drop a little bit. But effectively, a lot of people, what they'll do is they'll increase their home size and value as they, you know, build a family. So if they have kids, you know, they want better schools for their kids, all these things, people upgrade their home. And, you know, that's great. I think it's really the only way people can afford to live in higher priced homes is if they're upgrading over time and they upgrade as they can afford to. And I think kids is really the big factor that causes people to look at where they're going to buy their house or where they're going to live. Because if you're sending your kids to public school, you want to be in the best public school system possible. And of course, that causes those towns to be really expensive to live in.
Mm. So from the perspective of the taxes, because that's one thing I hear a lot about here, about how much the income taxes can vary just from town to town and from city to city. So is that what you're talking about there when you talk about the school system?
Yeah. So the school systems, we have, I guess there was some survey done in the last year and Massachusetts had the best school systems in the country. So I can speak to that being at the top end of that. The school systems around here, there are a handful of towns that are probably the best in the country if you consider that survey. And, you know, it ends up being really expensive to live in these towns because not only are the house prices really expensive, but also the tax rates are typically higher. And if the town happens to not have a big commercial section of the town, then your taxes will be even higher. I'll give you an example. So one town that has a good school system might be right around $13 per thousand in taxes. Whereas the neighboring town, which has almost no commercial and basically shares the other town's school system because they don't have a big enough town, is 19 per thousand. And the home prices are not much cheaper. So you have to assess the taxes of the town you're living in as well and what the impact is going to be for you. And if you happen to send your kids to private school, then you know, your taxes are more or less going to double because the private school costs are going to be expensive too. And you're not getting the benefit of the town. Whereas many towns, the school system takes up maybe, let's say, 75% of the revenue generated by the taxes. So the school systems take up a huge portion of the town's tax revenue. And that's obviously a big part of it. If you can live in the city, in some cities it's a lot cheaper, the taxes are a lot less expensive because there's a lot more commercial and other things that offset the residential taxes.
Mm. And I just wanted to clarify real quick. So you said 13,000 per thousand. What's the thousand on the second half of that?
It's $13 per thousand.
Oh, $13 per thousand. Okay, my bad.
Yeah, so 1.3% basically.
Got it.
Okay. So as we kind of talk about this, one of the articles that you had in this True Cost of Home Ownership piece, which is the second in the series, is granted some of these maintenance and replacement items are not predictable, but most of them have a predictable lifespan. That seems so simple. I mean, not to diminish the article because I've never thought of it, which just made a reflection on me, but how can people save for these predictable lifespan costs?
So most people are not this detail oriented. And I think that if you're making a big purchase, you need to be in some ways. But this is also one of the things that's overlooked in a big way. So we wrote about this about a year ago, the concept of an emergency fund. And the concept is effectively you're saving up, let's say, 6 to 12 months of your income in an account. You're not investing it. It's sitting in cash, FDIC insured. And it's as safe as can be. And you're not worried about making money on it. It's there to effectively keep you safe financially. So if an emergency happened, you're not worried about whether you can put it on your credit card. And I think that concept kind of lays into this in that if you own a car, you know it's a depreciating asset, right? So you own this car, you bought it for $20,000, 5 years from now it'll be worth $10,000. That's a depreciating asset. It just depreciates over time because it costs money to run it. It's worth less to everybody else. The same thing goes with your washer and dryer. It's got a lifespan of 10 years, let's say. At some point, you're going to have to replace it. So after 10 years, you're going to have to buy a new one. So the way that you would look at expenses like a washer, dryer, or a water heater, or whatever it might be, is to look at the useful life. So you'd start saving, say a washer dryer cost you $1,000. You'd start saving for the next 10 years, you start saving, you know, $100 a year. Mm-hmm. At the end of that time period, you'll have your $1,000 to replace it. But people don't generally do it this way, but if you want to look at this how a business would run or, you know, any sort of organization, they run a budget. And all you're effectively doing is budgeting for future capital expenses. So whether it's replacing the roof, replacing the driveway, whatever your expenses in your home might be, if you plan for that, then you'll be in much better shape in being prepared for these capital expenses that need to be paid for in future years. And you won't be surprised, as most people just get surprised and they deal with it. But a better way to handle it would be to save in advance. And that way, you're basically saving for expenses you know you're going to have in future years.
Now, that's something that I've personally thought about from a annual basis. So when I'm doing my budgeting, or at least what looks like a budget for the year, there are things, car expenses, it's going to break down, something's going to happen, oil changes. I do have a budget item that's an annualized number that I break down per month. And so it sounds like what you're suggesting here is people could do something similar, but they're essentially doing it over years, which I guess could be a little bit more difficult for folks to get someone to go, I'm going to need to buy this thing in 10 years, so I need to start putting away a little bit of money now. So would you suggest that people just have an ongoing monthly line item in their kind of annual month-to-month budget to start accounting for those things? Or are there other things you've seen people do to really cover those big expenses that come every few years, or every 10 years in this case?
Yeah, so if you're doing a budget and you're itemizing your budget, you know, by line item, then that's certainly one way to do it. You just, you know, allot bucks a month or whatever it might be into your savings account. Or what some people do, which is more convenient for most people who don't want to sit down and do a lot of numbers, many people are taking the basket approach. It's better to take the granular approach and do it by line item, but I think most people's brain doesn't work that way. So if you can do it the granular way, that's better, because then you can get a better idea of what your numbers are going to be. And that way you know how much more you need to save every month. If your brain doesn't work that way and it's too much effort, then the other way to do it is to look at items that you know will have a useful lifespan of, let's say, a washer dryer of 10 years, you're always going to need a washer dryer. So you can use that useful life of 10 years and say, I'm going to need to add an extra $50 a month indefinitely into savings, because that will effectively go to purchase a washer or dryer at some point.
Got it.
So I'm about to try to work through that screenshot that I've been mentally preparing the people for here. But, you know, the thesis line, if you will, the in a world, if this was a scary movie, would be this 30-year investment in a home results in $789.50 profit. And then I'm going to tell you how we got there. So if you purchase a home in this example, we're looking at $625,000. So it's one of those HGTV couples that I referred to. John is a stay-at-home musician, and his wife is a work-at-home mom with a budget of $625,000. At over 30 years, at rate of inflation, the value of the home would be $1.13 million. So it's looking good. Gain of $500,000. They're about $500,000. However, total amount of taxes that you'd pay in that time would be $387,000. Estimated amount of a maintenance cost to upkeep the home, as we're talking about here, is $258,000. Total interest paid on the mortgage amounts to $359,000. Haven't included factors like insurance and utilities, but even if we did not, the cost of owning your home for 30 years goes to $1 million itself, meaning you've had a profit of $126,000, which in itself sounds okay. But over a period of 30 years, even if you don't include the HOA fees, as we talk about here, you would have net $1,400.
Wait, so, wait. $1,400 profit?
$1,400.
Ooh.
I told you. So if you took your 20% down payment of the $125,000, you've gained $1,400. And that's $1,400 in today's dollars. So if you look at inflation, we're back to our $789.50 profit over 30 years.
That sounds abysmal.
So, of course, we end up at the inevitable. Is your home a good investment? In bold caps letters in the article, which we'll link to, no. And so, do you want to expand on that a little bit? And, you know, the saving grace, as I said, I try to end on a high note. We'll talk about some other investment options besides home ownership. But, Kirk, is there anything that I missed there you'd like to emphasize?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to bore us with too many numbers, but I can tell you that the important thing is to lay out the kind of future expectations and look at all the numbers on paper to really put some meat behind it. Because the concept of your home as an investment is very deeply ingrained in the American psyche. Everybody believes this. It's very well ingrained in there. So, I mean, I believed it. The only reason I did this because I was doing this case study for a client. And I realized, oh my God, this is one of those investing myths that I've just debunked. And I like doing this sort of thing. So it was really intriguing for me as a case study. But, you know, I think when people add up, so you think about it this way. If you're renting, what do you have to pay for? You have to pay rent. You know, you have to pay your utilities. But what else do you have to pay for? Pretty much nothing. I mean, you don't have to pay to maintain. If something breaks, the landlord pays for it. You don't pay for taxes. You don't pay for a mortgage. The home price goes up or down. You don't care. You're basically paying your rent every month. And, you know.
Parking spot, I guess, maybe.
hopefully.
Covered if you're fancy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, your expenses are minimal. But when you own a home, you know, you have to have a down payment, which is 20% at least. And, you know, if you can get away with less, that's fine. But let's just say for the sake of argument, you're putting down 20%. So in this example, let's call it $1 million home to make the numbers easy. You know, you're putting down $200,000. So you have to assume that, let's say, 2% inflation. So every year it goes up 2%. But your mortgage payment's going to be, let's call it 4%, even though it obviously can vary. Your taxes are 1.5%. Your maintenance costs are 1.5%. So effectively, you're paying 2.5% a year for taxes and maintenance. Your mortgage payment, some of it goes to principal, some of it to interest, but effectively, over a 30-year period, you're basically paying, what does it come out to, almost three times your mortgage. That's like 2.43 or something like that. But you pay a lot of interest over that time period, which effectively eats up the equity that you are building. So even though your home price may appreciate, it may be worth double, think of all the money you spent over that time period. So if you buy it for the 625 and now it's worth 1.1, great, you just made, you know, $500,000 and change. Awesome. But how much did you spend over that 30 years? In many cases, you've spent that amount of money or maybe even more to maintain the property. So you put down the down payment of, I think in this example, it was $125,000 that we used in the case study. So that $125,000 has done nothing for 30 years. You might as well have just stuck it under your mattress because it didn't grow, didn't go anywhere. It grew, but it didn't really do much for you. Now, if you take an alternative approach and you rented, and instead of paying those maintenance costs, mortgage fees, you just pay to rent, you take the difference and you invest it in, let's say, a CD, a certificate of deposit at 1%, you would have been better off. Or, you know, a bond or whatever it might be. But effectively, you're putting your $125,000 into something that's getting you a very safe interest every year. And a 30-year bond, let's say you're getting 2.9%, call it 3%. So you're getting 3% a year for 30 years on your $125,000 versus a home, which you're not growing at that period. So you're effectively just taking the difference and investing it. So it's just one way to look at it. It's not the only way to look at homeownership, but you know, it certainly ties into kind of the three methods of calculation that you can look at it, the cash flow, net expense, or highest best use. This would be the highest best use way of looking at your home, is what's the highest best use of that $125,000.
So I want to help the psychologically traumatized and remaining listeners that didn't have an aneurysm yet. So where does it factor in if you purchase your home and you're 3 to 5 years in and then you sell? How does that affect this calculation? Is there a profit then to take into consideration?
So in my opinion, and actually the 3 to 5 years is the most common, it's, I think it's around 5 years or so, is right around the average time that people move their homes. So people move on average every 5 years. So if you think you're going to stay there for 30 years, you better have your lifetime home, because most people don't. You know, they buy a condo, they upgrade to a, you know, single family, they upgrade that. So even if you have a 30-year mortgage, you're never, you know, most people are maybe using 5 to 10 years of it, and then they're refinancing via a new home. So if you're going through that process and you're really looking to do it in a 3 to 5 year period, think about some other expenses we didn't talk about. So what does it cost to get in and out of a house? On average, let's say 3 to 6%. You have to list your house and sell it. You have to buy it. Most brokers charge 6%. Let's be nice and say it's only 3%. You're going to have to pay 3% of your home value in that 3 to 5 year period. That's of your value. So if you only put 20% down and you're paying 3% of the value, so you have to multiply your 3% by 5. And that's the amount you have to overcome. Okay. So you effectively have to appreciate your home by 15% to get enough equity to just break even with the costs of buying and selling a home.
Yeah, and I like this a lot, because I think the reason there's such a gap between people's understanding of renting and buying, and you speak to these in the articles, is people tend to only look at the renting, how much it literally costs me to rent versus how much it literally costs me to pay my mortgage. And I don't think we're looking at a lot of these factors that we're putting in as far as maintenance, taxes, upkeep throughout the year, and unforeseen expenses that comes with home ownership. And I think that is really rarely had in a lot of these home ownership versus renting discussions that I've seen. And that seems to be a similar experience for yourself. You also talked about the return of $125,000. So people have some context around that. If we put in that treasury bond, you estimated 3%. That's also in the article. Just to give some numbers, that's $178,000. So you've made about $50,000 over that 30-year period versus $789.50. And then if you invested in the stocks, you also talk about the performance for the last 30 years. And this was really driving home that point. If you invested at $125,000 and had a return of approximately 8%, you'd be looking at $1.4 million. That is a sizable difference in your net worth.
Indeed.
Yep. Yeah, it's funny because the financial service industry has a very good PR team in general. They always take the best, they're master statisticians, right? So they take the numbers and they craft a great story with it. I remember in 99, them talking about how there's never a 10-year period where the market lost money, or, you know, it's on average 10 or 12% a year for over 100 years. So, you know, and that's always obviously a point of time. If you said this in 2008, you would have said, well, no, obviously it's not the case. But, you know, so it's always a perspective that they sell it. But I will say that if you look at various time periods, and I actually just wrote about this month, somebody did a statistical study over the last 100 years and then the 100 years before that and what the equity prices were. And I was actually shocked, so I have to say it here. Over the last 100 years, through various time periods, the average return from equities was between 8 and 10% annualized over that period. But if you go back 100 years prior to that, it was actually 0%. For 100 years, your return would have been 0%.
Wow.
So it's all about perspective. And I think that's what people have to understand. It's about what perspective you're looking at. If you're buying it at the top of the market, then obviously you should not expect 10% a year. If you're buying at the bottom, then, you know, it might be even better. But the stock position of, you know, if you had assumed it was earning 8.4%, which I think is a reasonable assumption over a long period of time, then, yeah, I mean, you would have exponentially grown your money more than if you had invested in just CDs or invested nothing and just put it in your house. Because, you know, owning a home, and this is one concept that is also important. Owning a home, unless you're paying all cash, you're using leverage, a huge amount of leverage, more so than you would get in almost any other investment. You're leveraging your money at 20% down of 5 times. So for every 1% your home appreciates, you're making 5%. And that works both ways. That works up and down. You can't do this in the financial markets outside of using options, but you know, virtually nothing else that's a sustainable investment can you do this sort of thing. And in equities, you have 2-to-1 leverage. So maybe banks. Banks can do 20-to-1. They're a little different.
Yes, they are. And so to drive this home from the third article in the series, and again, this will all be there, what you don't know about renting versus buying can cost you, and I think we've touched on this a little bit here, actually a lot of it here, is if you rent a home, it is an expense. When you buy a home, it is an expense. If you buy a home and rent it out to a third party, it becomes an investment. And a better way to explain it is when you are renting, you rent from a landlord. When you buy a home to live in, you are renting from yourself. I thought that really kind of drove home this whole conversation as far as where your money is really going. You're paying someone, unless actually, as you say in the article, unless you live in a tent, it's an expense.
That's very true. That's very true.
Perhaps depending on the land for you to eat, at least anyway, even that tent might be expensive. I might be able to find somewhere out here in Texas where I could lay down a tent for a reasonable cost.
Oh, man.
So we have a listener question here that we also want to touch on from an Ivan. So thank you for writing in, or in this case, speaking in. Rich, why don't you run that beautiful voicemail footage?
I hope this works.
Hey guys, this is Ivan from Denver. I just wanted to see if you guys have any good advice on which index funds people in their early 30s, they're, you know, making around $40,000, $50,000 a year, around which ones are good, easy to use, and, you know, that requires around $2,000 to $3,000 to start. I would appreciate it. Thank you. I always listen to you guys' website. You guys keep going and keep doing it, what you're doing. You're helping a lot of people. Thank you. Bye.
Appreciate it, Ivan.
So, Kirk, what do you think?
So, I mean, this is a great question. And I think it's a question that it's important to discuss for many different ways. You know, I think somebody who's starting out and is looking at investing, assuming that they don't take my advice to take a lot of time to educate themselves, which most people don't have. So, you know, I don't want to overlook that. But, you know, looking at a way to invest, indexing is actually a simple way for most people to invest. It's, I don't want to call it mindless. It's a simple way to invest because all you're doing is you're investing in the market. You're taking your own human deficiencies out of the equation. And by that, I don't mean you, Ivan. I mean any of us, including myself. Like, I have my own psychological, let's just say, drawbacks when I invest. And I know what those are. And as long as I know what they are, it helps me tackle them. So for somebody who's just looking to get started, I think index investing is great. I think in the past, companies like Vanguard have done a great job at advertising index investing and index funds. And they have probably one of the best index funds out there. However, with the invention of ETFs, which are exchange-traded funds, they've effectively solved some problems with the mutual fund index investing. They certainly have created some other ones, but in many ways, they've solved some problems. So your cost for owning a Vanguard mutual fund, let's say the S&P 500 index, is probably going to be one of the lowest you'll find for the mutual fund expenses. However, if you find an ETF that invests in the same index, there are some that are actually about, let's say, half the expense of the Vanguard mutual fund. So I would consider ETFs over mutual funds if you're trying to find one of with the lowest costs. I would say that the ETFs are also more liquid, and you know, you also have more options with them. So they're more liquid in that you can buy or sell them in any given day, which may not be a benefit to somebody who's just learning, because you don't want to be able to get in and out at the drop of a hat. You want to stay invested. If that's your investment strategy, you don't want to have to jump out because the market's crashing. However, with the ETFs, it does allow you to do other things with them, like hedge them with options, which is a much more advanced technique, but you can't do that with a mutual fund, but you can do it with an ETF. However, when you're looking at ETFs, I want to state this, with mutual funds, you don't have many of these problems, but with ETFs, you have some issues that do crop up. One of them is you want to make sure that you're finding an ETF with a high daily average volume or average daily volume. And the reason for this is if you're trying to invest in like the SPY, which is the most common S&P 500 index, it has really high daily volume. There's no way an individual, no matter who you are, is going to move the market in and of itself. The volume is just too great. However, if you're investing in like an industry or a sub-industry, let's say you're investing in like gold miners and you're investing in like the GDX, which is a gold mining index, you have to look at what the holdings are. So you have to look at things like, for instance, I think in GDX, the top two stocks comprise 20% of the index, which is not really optimal if you're trying to diversify yourself. The top four stocks are a third of the index, and the top seven stocks comprise 50% of the index. That's not really diversified. Now, the index itself is, there aren't as many stocks to choose from, so you have to take that into consideration. But so if you want to invest in like solar energy index, I would not advise that. There's just too few companies, it would be too concentrated. So if you're starting out, I would look at the broad picture. So the U.S. markets, I would look at the S&P 500. I wouldn't look at the Dow Jones index. You can look at the NASDAQ, but in general, most people consider the S&P 500 to be a close proximity to what the U.S. economy will do for larger companies. You should also own some mid-cap and small-cap indices that have high daily volume. You should also own international as well. And so I had this chart recently in one of my posts. I do a monthly inflation monitor where we put out a bunch of charts. And there's one interesting one I saw in that 100 years ago, the U.S. was, I believe, 15% of the global economy. Today, it's like 53, 54% of the global economy. So if you're looking to diversify, most people, and that's not just Americans, but around the world, most people have a home country bias, meaning that they're only investing in their own country. They don't invest internationally. However, it is an important part of a portfolio because, as you know, the reason you diversify into different ETFs, into different sectors and segments of the economy, is that when one does well or when one does not do well, you have some that are doing well to offset it. So over time, that reduces your risk of the portfolio through diversification. So if you have proper diversification, and there are many tools out there now, there are robo-advisors, and there are many other public tools you can use to find a proper diversification. But you want to consider that diversifying will lower your overall risk of your investment exposure. So in 2008, when most investments lost 50% of value over that 12-month period, you know, if you own bonds, if you own gold, cash, that would have reduced your losses because those things actually appreciated during that time. So I think that's an important consideration when you're looking at indexing, is which index you're using, the volume, and making sure you're not just putting it all into one index, but you're diversifying. So with ETFs, you can find a low-cost discount broker like Fidelity or TD Ameritrade or Schwab, and might cost you, it used to cost $10. Now they've all dropped their price. I think it's $5 now. So you could buy one index for, you know, $2,000 or whatever it might be, and that'll be a low cost as long as you keep it. But remember also that you have transaction costs. So, you know, let's say if you, you know, if you're investing $2,000, that's going to be about 25 basis points of your return in expense just for the buy. So you get about 0.5% of a buy and a sell with that position. So you don't want to do it for $500 because then it starts to be, you know, that's 1% of your investment that you have to make up. But, you know, if you could do larger amounts and just buy and hold, then that's going to be a very cost-effective way to invest in the market without having to learn extensive investing acumen to become just adequate. I mean, there's so many smart people out there investing in the markets that even the smart people are not necessarily the best because there's so many of them out there. So I think an index approach is a smart way to approach investing for beginning investors.
Nice.
And I appreciate that. And thank you, Ivan, for the question. And thank you, Kirk, for the response. And I should have opened with this, so this is my fault, but we've touched on it a variety of ways. But from Investopedia, an index fund is said to provide market exposure, low operating expenses, and low portfolio turnover. So I think that's why you're saying it's a conservative way to get into the market for those of us who are just starting out. And I wanted to hit on, it sounded like you did answer this question. As far as the how-to, you're saying that maybe that, I guess I'll describe it as an intermediary, but you could go to a broker of your choice and you're saying maybe that's a personal decision as far as getting into the market or doing it yourself?
Yeah, I think in some ways, I mean, obviously we provide financial advice for individuals, but what we do is not for everybody. And, you know, people with smaller amounts of money, it's not cost-effective for you to find a financial advisor. However, in this day and age, thankfully, because of technology, starting investors, people with smaller amounts, actually do have access to things like robo-advisors and these other technologies which help them allocate properly. There's a lot of good articles out there about proper allocation. And the one big thing with the allocation that, and this may be more advanced, but it's also something that I think people need to know, is if you look at the history, because a lot of financial modeling, which is effectively looking at the past and trying to figure out where things are going. All the modeling that Wall Street does is based on past performance. And there's always a disclaimer of past performance is no guarantee of future results. However, they model all of their financial equations on past performance, which is kind of humorous when you think about it. But The modeling that they do is based on past performance. Well, if you look at the last 30 some odd years, we've had the biggest bond bull market in as far back as I can remember, where bonds have done nothing but make money every single year, you know, more or less. And we're at the end of that. I mean, you know, you can't say for sure, but it's hard to go below zero. And interest rates are starting to climb. Well, what people don't realize is bonds lose money. When interest rates go up, bonds lose in value. So given that is true, people have to consider the bond exposure in their portfolio and how that impacts their returns. So that's one thing that I think people need to read about more, is that bonds are not safe. They used to be safe when we were in a bond bull market, but now I would not consider them safe unless you're buying and holding to maturity, because you could lose value in the bond more than just getting the income. So it's kind of an advanced topic to take a long time to talk about, but I think it's important to consider that if you're going into retirement, let's say, putting all your money in bonds might not keep you safe where in the past it would have.
Got it.
So, as I said, this has been a great conversation, but sorry, folks, we're nearing the wrap up, and I'm sure y'all going to write in with your questions and concerns. We'll follow up with that. But is there any social media websites that you'd like to plug, Kirk, that you want the people to visit?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you can find me on social media. I'm pretty easy to find on most social media channels. My website, if you go to innovativewealth.com, that's where you can find me. That's where my company is, my company's website. I write almost all the blog posts, so you can kind of look through there and learn about me. If you, you know, for some odd reason you're interested in financial advice, that's the best way to get to know me, because I write all the stuff. So it's kind of my thoughts inside and out.
Awesome.
Nice.
And so you said you're easy to find, but I don't think I caught the handle where people could find you on Twitter or Instagram or whichever platforms you're on.
Okay. So I'm on Twitter. It's just Kirk Chisholm, and it's K-I-R-K-C-H-I-S-H-O-L-M. That's my Twitter handle. I'm not on Instagram. I probably should be, but you know, for whatever reason, I'm not.
No, you should.
You can find me. You can find me on LinkedIn, Google Plus. Also, I'm not sure why I'm on there. No one else is.
Shade.
But no, you know, it's not quite the same place.
Yeah, it's not what it was like 5 years ago. So
yeah,
I understand.
But I'm on Facebook. But most of the stuff you can get from our blog, and actually have a free gift for your listeners if they're interested. It is a rent versus buy calculator where you can actually use the calculator to help you make better decisions on whether you buy versus rent. That's a free gift for listeners if they're interested.
Awesome, awesome. And how do they get to that?
Actually, you can get to that. I assume you guys will have some sort of a link, but it's just innovativewealth.com/BP. #podcast.
Okay, cool. So folks, again, as I know folks may be driving or wherever else, innovativewealth.com/pb-podcast to get that free giveaway. I'm sure there are some folks who are out there thinking about whether they should rent, buy, and I'm sure they'll find that calculator, which will definitely come in handy for them. So
no texting and driving, folks. We'll have that in the show notes. There's no need to pull over the car. We'll get that out to you.
Yeah, so Kirk, again, great to have you on the podcast. It's been really insightful, a lot of information for the listeners, and I'm sure the people will get something from this.
Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate you guys bringing me on. You guys have a great podcast, and you do a lot of great work for your listeners, and I hope they appreciate all the valuable information that you have. So I appreciate you both inviting me on.
Definitely, definitely. And so we want to thank everyone for listening to this episode. Don't forget to join our email list where we share helpful stories we read throughout the week, actionable work and money tips, and a lot more. You can sign up by visiting paychecksandbalances.com/email.
And if you've been enjoying the show, don't forget to subscribe and leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. If you don't know how, just visit paychecksandbalances.com/review.
And all these links and magical things you will find in the show notes on the website. So again, thanks to everyone for listening. Hope you get your money up, your bank accounts up, debt balances down. Until next time, be safe. We out. Peace.